Okay, I'm going to go ahead and start. Hello everyone, I'm Mary Wilde, and it's a real pleasure to be back at the Freud Museum to be giving a talk. And this is the first installment of a three-part course called Projection, Cinema, Hysteria. I'm really going to be enjoying this course because this is a topic really close to my heart. So I'm really grateful to all of you for registering and for being here this evening on a stormy night. Let's see if I can unfreeze. Oh, yes. So for those of you who haven't come to one of my lectures before, I'll just give you a little bit of background about myself. I'm from Montreal, where I took a degree in psychology. I came over to London nearly 10 years ago now to pursue postgraduate studies and work in psychoanalysis, which I applied to film. I wrote my MPhil dissertation on Marilyn Monroe, which is why I'm really excited to see that the exhibition also holds a little bit about Marilyn, so that was really cool. And my work on Marilyn led me to discover the British Film Institute, where I currently work. I've developed a lecture series called Projections, which is based on a term found in both psychoanalysis and cinema. And the aim is to explore themes and motifs contained in film through Freudian and also Lacanian concepts. In addition to the Freud Museum, I've also lectured at the SAE Institute, CityLit, and BFI SoftBank. So this course has been programmed as part of the Mad, Bad, and Sad series at the Freud Museum, which has been going on since the 10th of October and I believe finishes on the 2nd of February. So if you haven't already picked up some brochures downstairs, do please go ahead. It's very interesting. The thing that led me to conceptualize and write this course is that I was kind of thinking back on 2013, and it was a very eventful year in terms of all sorts of news stories coming from all over the world about global struggle, international conflict, stories about increasing world poverty and austerity, not to mention climate change. And yet it seemed that the news, or at least the corporate mainstream news, was oversaturated with inane sort of coverage of Miley Cyrus twerking and other absurd headline-grabbing stories centering specifically around women's bodies. Now, this can be written off as mainstream corporate, you know, tactic to brainwash and distract. Fair enough, it probably is, and it's probably part of an agenda of dumbing down. But my question is, why does the female body often serve this device of distraction and, sort of keeping us not really paying attention to the bigger stories? What is it about femininity that mystifies and casts a hypnotic spell on audiences, men and women alike? And why is it that also women are portrayed in this kind of very degrading way as well? Disembodied parts of their bodies magnified with meaning that they don't intend to have. So I just found this whole topic really interesting, and I like the fact that, you know, in psychoanalytic theory, hysteria provides a refreshing perspective on the mystery of femininity and deals with desire as part of the path to uncover this mystery. I find this is something a bit lacking in modern psychiatry, obviously with the diagnosis of hysteria no longer being used in the same way as it was before. And so this dialogue, this conversation about the centrality of femininity and the mystery and evocativeness of femininity seems to have disappeared from modern psychiatric conversations. And also, I'm a film lover, I'm a cinephile, and I watch films, and sometimes I'll sit there and think, oh yeah, that's a really good representation of the condition of hysteria. And I thought it would be interesting to collect, you know, my of course, it's always my own projection of what I think hysteria is to me, but I thought it would be interesting to collate all of these scenes into a course and present them, and also ask, you know, your opinion and what you associate might be a good scene, an iconic scene in film. So I want to catch that hysteria vibe, you know, in film. So the course, we're going to be mainly studying femininity from the understanding of, well, the Freudian Lacanian perspective of hysteria, and it basically aims to look at the different, what I would like to call the sort of stages of the hysteric condition as I see them, starting off tonight exclusively on seduction. So we're going to be looking at some film clips from genres of erotica and romance, looking at sort of the mystery, desire and attraction associated with the seduction and how that functions in cinema. Next week, we'll move on from seduction to demons, and looking at film clips from horror and melodrama films, looking at repression, haunting, possession, that sort of thing. And then the third and final part of the course, I'm calling transcendence, so focusing mainly on films from the genres of fantasy and sci-fi, science fiction. And then looking specifically at themes of transformation, apotheosis, and catharsis. Anyway, I hope that's all going to make sense at the end. That's just sort of my intention anyway. So in ancient Greek mythology, Zeus punished Prometheus for trying to play a trick on him by sending him woman. It was the sort of precursor of Eve in the Garden of Eden. And women, of course, featured so heavily in Greek mythology, is irresistible, the one you can't do without, but she also makes men suffer. What the ancient Greeks called kalon kakon, a beautiful bad thing or beautiful evil. And in these stories, the women pose a threat because of man's need for them, the need to have children, and also the male fear of losing control to the woman because of the desire that she evokes. So there's this sort of running theme of the overwhelming feminine sexuality disconcerting men. This happens many times. Just looking specifically at the birth of Aphrodite as an example, a classic case. Obviously, we know that, one of the versions, I think there's two versions of her birth, but one of the versions is that Cronos, who was the child of Gaia and Uranus, I think he was being prevented from being born, so he sought revenge against his father by severing his genitals, Uranus's genitals, and throwing them into the sea. And out of the sea foam rises Aphrodite, fully formed goddess on a scallop shell, and depicted here in the Botticelli rendition of this story, a painting. So it's interesting that right from, the origin of her, the myth attached to her birth, there's castration. So there's this beautiful, sexually alluring, absolutely irresistible woman. So, naturally very attractive, and men, want to go towards her, but there's this fear attached to her as well. She's a beautiful bad thing, a kalon kakon. So she, represents the possibility of castration because in her very being, right from her conception, there was this, severing of her grandfather's genitals, as it were. So mortal men who slept with Aphrodite were afraid of being emasculated by her, that they would lose their male power. So having just said all of that, I'm going to stop and show the first clip, which is from Roman Polanski's film Bitter Moon. It stars actually Emmanuel Seignier, and I think they got married. I think they're still married now. But it was released in 1992. So I'm just going to show you a clip. And in this clip, it's a sort of classic, I suppose you could say, depiction of the first stage of seduction and love in a romantic scenario where you can't get enough of each other and there's lust and an overwhelming desire. And then suddenly it starts to change and the desire goes from, a source of happiness and joy to suddenly something else, poses a kind of danger. So without further ado, I'll just go ahead and play the clip. think it's a terrifying thought, the thought of Hugh Grant as my analyst, but alright. So that's probably the longer clip that we'll be watching. So I'll just say some things about what we've just seen. So Bitter Moon is the title of the film, as opposed to Honeymoon. And it's really here the depiction of a devouring woman. We hear the male character saying, you know, the lover, he says, nothing ever surpassed the rapture of that first awakening. I was Adam, and the taste of apple was still fresh in my mouth. I was looking at all the beauty in the world embodied in a single female form, and I knew with sudden blinding certainty this was it. So this is really sort of capturing the ultimate, you know, goddess, beautiful woman that no man could ever resist, and it's a very sort of admiring, positive, glowing reflection of femininity in the stage of seduction. And when you see them sort of spinning round and round in the fairground ride, and he declares that he loves her, well, I thought actually that was a very good sort of moment to capture that first utterance of the word love, because as I had said once before in a previous lecture, it seems that, you know, I think it was actually Jean Baudrillard who said that, you know, he doesn't understand why lovers are compulsively repeating to each other all the time that they love each other. You know, why can't they just establish it once and for all? You know, I love you, okay, let's move on. But compulsively, constantly repeating, you know, I love you, I love you. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I do it all the time with my boyfriend. But it's this kind of repetition of spinning round and round, and also capturing the kind of, you know, the sort of dizziness that you get on these rides, and associating that, linking that very intimately with love, and that first initial soaring, you know, dizzying feeling of falling in love. And the private sort of dance sequence that we saw, it reminded me a lot of Brigitte Bardot in God Created Woman. You know, she's so beautiful in the scene. She's such a beautiful dancer. She looks, you know, Emmanuelle Seigner, she looks like a goddess, you know, with all the lights dimmed, and he's just transfixed. You know, he can't look anywhere else. So it's very cleverly done. Actually, before I get to that, the next morning at the breakfast table, that was a very playful scene with the sort of spitting out of the milk and everything. I thought she looked a bit like a zombie, actually. But it's this sort of, it's done very playfully with like the George Michael song and having faith, and it's just this. It starts off obviously very suggestive, playing around with the cream and milk, and then she does sort of proceed to fellatio. So it's literally sort of ingesting him as her lover. But then that sort of evolves, you know, the devouring ingesting of the male lover evolves, where she's teasing him about his blade and why is he using an electric razor? Why is he doubling around with a blade? Isn't it dangerous? And she's like, oh, I know, it makes you feel macho. Now, Polanski has previously used the razor blade as a phallus symbol before in Repulsion. If you remember the Catherine Deneuve character, you know, she didn't like it when her sister's married boyfriend would stay over and leave his razor in her bathroom glass. She always kept removing it from the glass constantly. So it's sort of, again, equating the razor blades with the phallic, you know, sort of power of the man. She teases him and she says it makes you feel macho. So then she takes control of the razor blade and inevitably cuts him. And then she does, you know, again with the devouring theme continuing, she licks the sort of little flesh wound with the blood. You know, this is when it switches. It goes from being playful, fun, and sexy to dangerous. You know, she's unhinged. She's drinking my blood. And then that's when it's at that point that we hear the voiceover of the lover recounting the experience to Hugh Grant and saying, you know, sort of depicting the whole seduction scenario and actually her genitalia, recounted in to very uncomfortable detail to, you know, Hugh Grant in explicit detail, to show how unquote unquote, you know, completely enslaved he was, body and soul. And he's warning Hugh Grant, he's warning him against her dangerous powers as this sort of seductress, and he of course denies that, you know. But yes, so this is, I thought it was a really good sort of capturing of the seductive, devouring woman. So it sort of leads me to carry on now talking a little bit about, well, in a way, castration, because, well, castration is a big deal in psychoanalysis. Of course, there's, it features heavily in Freud's initial writings, and Lacan also picks up on it. But, you know, you can have, of course, castration of the penis, you know, something that you have is removed, but it can also be, you know, beyond the penis. It can be, you know, the heart, autonomy, knowledge, status, something that you hold dear, of value, is taken away. You feel castrated. And the femme fatale's role here, femme fatale from French, literally meaning fatal woman or deadly woman, she depletes the penis through the sexual act, but she also has the potential of stealing her lover's heart, removing something away from him. And so the fear of castration in the male, let's say in the male lover, but also in the male filmmaker, is important to say, leads to strategies of containment of the female body. And this has been explored a lot by feminist film theorists, beginning with, I think Laura Mulvey, where the male desire to suppress the woman leads to over-investing in her body parts, so exaggerating her parts, you know, the female body becomes fetishized in this way, over-endowed with meaning, and therefore less threatening as a castrating agency. So this is really, really topical even today, you know, when you do see so many sort of women's magazine articles, features, and a sort of constant where, and the Daily Mail actually are very guilty of this with their extremely popular website that lots of people are, you know, feel very guilty about visiting, but they feel compelled to go. It's like a car crash just to see what they're putting there. But it's always, you know, wardrobe malfunctions and weight gains and breast reduction, augmentation. It's always like focusing on the different parts of the female body, fetishizing it. But it's important to recognize that it is an act of a strategy of containing her sexuality, her overwhelming sexuality. The cinematic image also provides a safe distance for the emergence of voyeurism, which is completely, you know, which is very much bound up with the principle of lawless seeing. And cinematic seduction is founded on scopophilia, which Freud talked about, the pleasure of looking, you know, people who get off just from looking at the other, where one can spy. In the cinema, of course, where one can spy on others without negative consequence. You don't get into trouble for being a peeping Tom in the cinema. We all pay tickets to be peeping Toms in the cinema. That's how it works. So having said this, I'm now going to introduce another clip, and actually two back-to-back, which deal with the same sort of thing, just in different forms. Both of them dealing with extremely iconic and famous scenes of women in white dresses. I'm talking about Marilyn Monroe in Seven Year Itch, the famous standing over the subway grating, you know, with white dress billowing. So I'm just going to set that up for you first. So yes, Seven Year Itch. Obviously, a reflection of conservative attitudes towards women in the 1950s. And here the woman, you know, is presented as infantile, like a child, very innocent, teasing him a little bit, but obviously unintentionally flirtatious. Because, you know, he happens to be a married man and they're just going to a wholesome, you know, friendly film together. Nothing dangerous or devouring about that. Or is it? And the kiss is a result of just a wholesome point being made about toothpaste. So it's completely unintentional. And also, we tend to think of that scene, certainly in my memory, I think of of the pictures I've seen on the production and the fact that we do actually see Marilyn's underwear. And famously, Billy Wilder told Marilyn to make sure she was wearing three pairs of underwear to film the scene because the censors were breathing down his neck and he didn't want any trace of anything being, you know, being revealed in the scene. So she was actually wearing three pairs of underwear. But in the final cut of the film, you don't actually see her pelvis. He only shoots, you know, her legs basically, and just see the skirt billowing. So the pelvis is hidden. And it's interesting to hear her say that she identifies with the creature from the Black Lagoon, you know, because actually, oh, he's not all that bad. He's kind of sweet. He just wants to be loved. You know, so she's identifying with him in his position. And I find it kind of interesting because in the next scene I'm going to be showing you, Sharon Stone not only identifies with the dangerous creature, but she is the dangerous creature. So let's just have a look at that, and then I'll say a few words about Basic Instinct. It's kind of funny to see Newman from Seinfeld interrogating Sharon Stone. Right. So just going back to the comparison with 7 Year Itch. So here, the woman's all, you know, grown up. She's not infantile anymore, and she's not conservative. Far from it. She still teases the sort of love interest, let's say, or the Michael Douglas character. She teases him relentlessly with the, you know, tempting him with cigarettes and all of that. But of course, she's also tempting him with herself. And when they get to the police station, the police officer's fear of castration is definitely implied. Here's a strong, phallic woman represented as sexually armed and dangerous, and she's in charge of her own sexual destiny. You know, she says that she chooses her lovers on her terms, and she doesn't pretend to love them or anything like that. She just, you know, she knows what she wants and she goes after it. And she boasts about her sexual conquests whilst being questioned for murder. So this is the ultimate Kalon Kakan, the ultimate beautiful bad thing. So we already know that looking at both 7 Year Itch and Basic Instinct, that they're good examples of voyeurism. And they're also good examples of fetishism because, especially in Basic Instinct, the fact that she's being fetishized through her dress tells us that she's, this is a strategy of containment by the male gaze. Despite her transgressive behavior, despite the fact that she does cocaine and she's bisexual and all these things, it is a strategy of containment. Her sexuality, her feminine sexuality, is too overwhelming for this kind of panel of male police officers. So they stare, and the filmmaker fetishizes her body parts, and her sort of way to combat this. Where Marilyn was playing coy to the camera in 7 Year Itch, and she was sort of laughing and giggling and being coy. Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct sort of revolts against the strategy of containment by basically flashing her vagina.
Can you explain this containment thing? I'm not quite following.
Sure. So feminist film theorists said that strategies of containment in terms of looking at women and acting as defenses in relation to their overwhelming sexual power, or overwhelming sexual aura, two ways that men sort of approach this potentially threatening presence of feminine sexuality is to contain, sort of fence off their sexuality by two methods. Voyeurism, which is just basically you're the one who controls the gaze and you're the one who spies on the sort of unsuspecting woman. And fetishism is to endow her body parts with greater meaning, exaggerated meaning. So I feel that from my point of view, these two things are operating very heavily in 7 Year Itch and Basic Instinct. These particular examples. So there's sort of defenses against the fear of castration.
Even when Sharon Stone is kind of flaunting herself,
yes,
it's still the men who are containing her.
Yes, yes, I would say so. I would say so. And I would say it's also the director, Paul Verhoeven. And I think, did he also direct Showgirls as well? So this is, that's also done very much, you know, in response to the overwhelming feminine sexuality on display in Showgirls and Basic Instinct. The filmmaking strategy is to voyeuristically ogle the woman and also fence off her sexuality by fetishizing her body parts. Hence why I think that her sort of crossing her legs suggestively and revealing that she's not wearing underwear, you know, maybe that's a little bit of a revolt, you know, but she still ends up being fetishized in the end. But ultimately, she says, whereas Marilyn's pelvis was hidden, so she was wearing three pairs of underwear, we never saw her pelvis in the final cut of Seven-Year Itch, just in the still photographs. Here, we hear the Sharon Stone character declaring, I have nothing to hide. I can take a lie detector test. I'm telling the truth. So she's telling the truth about her femininity. As much as the male gaze would like to fence off her femininity, it's still going to be exposed and still going to be devouring. This is the sense I got from watching these films. So I'm just going to move straight on to Wandering Womb, from Sharon's sort of nether regions to Wandering Womb. So hysteria was always sort of thought as being specific to women and associated with the womb. And in ancient Greece, female illness and sickness was always sort of attributed to hysteria. I think Plato and Timaeus said, the womb is a living creature within the woman, and it longs to bear children. And if it's left unfertilized long beyond normal time, it causes extreme unrest, moving around the body, blocking channels of breath, and causing distress. And so the uterus was being compared to an animal within an animal, causing pathologies such as choking, sleepiness, loss of speech, vertigo, headaches, heartburn, and even death could be attributed to the wandering womb. So it was really just the fetus that could be seen as a restorative agency, anchoring this roaming uterus inside the woman's body. And of course, it was the male's gift to the woman. Oh, here you are, you poor sick woman, you know, I'll make love with you, and you can conceive, and then you'll be cured of this hysteria, this wandering uterus. And so this theory actually, bizarrely enough, persisted in Europe for centuries, though obviously ultimately disproved. But Freud's theory of the free-floating unconscious, or the free-floating signifier within the unconscious, the mind within the mind, was similar in a way, you could say, to the ancient belief in the animal within the animal. So I much prefer Freud's, of course, much more imaginative idea of the mind within the mind. And really, where hysteria is situated in the sort of psychoanalytic diagnostics. There's neurosis, which is a diagnostic category, which stands opposed to the psychosis and perversion in Lacan. And within neurosis, you have kind of two substructures. There's obsessional neurosis, and that's the typically male patient. Who's suffering from an existential crisis centering around life and death, asking questions like, am I dead or alive? And hysteria is the second substructure, typically female patients with problems centering around sexuality and desire, asking questions, am I a woman or a man? What does it mean to be a woman? How does my femininity manifest itself? This sort of thing. And even today, whilst the diagnosis of hysteria is not recognized in modern psychiatry, the word hysterical or hysteria has certain connotations. If I say to someone, oh, you're being hysterical, it sort of connotes emotional excess, loss of self-control. And this was a sort of catch-all diagnosis for a long list of symptoms at the time. Paralysis of the arm. This is especially, you know, when Freud was recording his analytic sessions with his patients, a lot of them suffered from paralysis of the arm, loss of voice, vision abnormalities, deafness, seizures, and convulsions. And I'll be looking at these much more closely in the second part of the course that I'm calling demons. And it was, in fact, Is it Bertha Pappenheim, Anna O, who came up with the term talking cure, where she, you know, Freud noticed that the symptoms were disappearing after she and other patients talked about their problems. So, the psychology, psychotherapy as we know it, originates in this kind of very idea that you can get rid of your symptoms by talking about them, you know, the talking cure. And so hysteria for Freud, who was strongly, you know, influenced by Jean-Martin Charcot at Salpêtrière in Paris, he didn't believe that that organic lesions cause these symptoms. He saw hysteria as a conversion of psychological stress into physical symptoms, somatization, or a change in self-awareness, like a fugue state or selective amnesia. So the symptoms were caused by unconscious attempts to protect the patient from anxiety. And Freud initially had a seduction hypothesis, believing that these symptoms were exclusively created by molestation taking place in childhood. But he later abandoned that rigid sort of view and included within that fantasies as an equally probable cause of neurotic symptoms. And I'm just going to have a deeper look at one specific case, Dora, who's a Freud's 18-year-old patient who he treated in 1900 for 11 weeks. Her real name was Ida Bauer, and she suffered from nervousness and loss of voice. The case study discusses the importance of transference and countertransference because ultimately Freud had some regrets about Dora because she was, as it says in the exhibition, she was the only woman who walked out on Freud. She didn't complete the treatment with Freud. And he later attributed that to his lack of understanding or lack of consideration in terms of transference and countertransference. So he obviously developed that a lot more later on. Lacan famously said that it was femininity that was Dora's real center of interest. Because if we look really closely at the case, let's say for the purposes of this talk, basically you had Mrs. K, or Frau K, who had an extramarital affair with Dora's father, and Mrs. K's husband, Herr K, or Mr. K, he sexually propositioned a young Dora, teenage Dora. So Dora unconsciously was identifying with the men in the love triangle, the couple, Mr. and Mrs. K. Mr. K and her father. And in order to pursue the question, what makes a woman desirable to a man? She wanted to know, what did Mrs. K have that, you know, captivated her father's imagination enough that he would be unfaithful to Dora's mother? And whatever it was that Mrs. K had, whilst Dora, you know, didn't like her for causing trouble between her parents, and she also disliked her husband for propositioning her, yet at the same time, simultaneously, Freud thought that there might have been some identification going on as well. She was sort of perversely interested in what it was that Mrs. K had in her essence to be able to attract her father. So there was obviously Oedipal dynamics going on there. And she was also interested, it's this whole thing about the hysteric scrutinizing also male sexual desire and wondering what does a woman have if she can make a man fall in love with her beyond the dimension of sex. So having said that, I'm now going to play a clip from Luis Buñuel's 1967 film Belle de Jour. And this is a classic sort of example of identifying with the rival woman in order to understand male desire and in order to sort of enter that realm of sexuality within that identification. And then I'll say a bit more about it after we've seen the full clip. Yeah, so I thought when I first saw the film that scene in particular reminded me of the Dora case study in the sense of identifying with another woman in order to, with a rival woman actually, in order to in a way learn, you know, it's like a schooling in seduction. And that's literally what's happening here in this scene. But ultimately for this character, the Catherine Deneuve character, she's also interested in love beyond the realm of the sexual. She is a beautiful Parisian housewife who seems to be unable to make love with her husband, so she's suffering from frigidity, despite, or maybe because, she loves him. She has bondage fantasies and ends up entering the world of prostitution. Now, her name in French is Séverine, which you can, it reminds me anyway, my free association with that word, to sever, forcibly divide by cutting or slicing, putting an end to and breaking off. Now, it's interesting because she does end up ultimately severing or forcibly sort of dividing the two aspects of her sexuality. On the one hand, she has these bondage fantasies and she's clearly interested in, let's say, alternative manifestations of sexuality. But on the other hand, she can't seem to bring herself to express that desire with her husband. So she's keeping this, you know, two separate definitions, and compartmentalizing sexuality and love. I'll get back to that in a bit, but it's important to also remark that the title of the film is actually a French pun, because the phrase belle de nuit is French for lady of the night, which means prostitute, and Séverine works as a prostitute during the day only. She always reminds her clients, I'm only available from 2 to 5, so she's belle le jour, lady of daytime. So there's this sort of dichotomy between day and night in the film, where during the day, she does indulge in the physical senses, and she confronts this truth about her body and her, the basic need of sexuality. But we always see her husband sort of approaching her in an intimate way, at nighttime in their bedroom. And so this seems to be the domain of love and the mystery of tenderness. And this is what she wants to keep separate, to sever these two things from ever connecting. And she seems to be equating sex with humiliation, masochism, and in some aspects of the film also brutality when she meets a French gangster. And love with, you know, she equates love with purity, virtue, and frigidity, because the way that she describes her husband as well, you know, it's in very, very pure, romantic, almost adolescent, very immature terms, about how she wants to spend every moment with him, and it seems very, very, very separate. I'm going to say a few words about the mirror stage and cinema as jouissance. We know from Lacan that the baby sees its unbroken, united reflection in the mirror and expresses what he calls jouissance, a jubilation, in narcissistic identification, which is separate from the mother, because up until that point, the baby must have, you know, connected itself entirely with the mother, because with breastfeeding and nappy changes, but suddenly there's this sort of, you know, new entity, this new image that the baby is being told is actually him or herself. So there's a sort of jouissance that occurs. The child sees that image, itself as whole, though until now it has felt fragmented and uncoordinated. It hasn't been able to walk, speak. It needs the mother and father for absolutely everything. But suddenly it sees in the mirror this ideal image, which invariably, inevitably leads to alienation, according to Lacan. The mirror image is held up also by the mother to be seen. So this is the child really is identifying with the mother's perception of itself. I am who my mother desires me to be. So in the same sense, jouissance occurs with spectators at the cinema when they identify with characters in the film, or particularly the way that they are portrayed, the way that the characters are portrayed by a certain director of the film. And in the same way that the baby forgets its fragmented reality, you know, not being able to talk, walk, do anything independently, and takes pleasure in seeing this image and being told, that's you, that perfect, unified, unfragmented baby is you. And he's so excited and happy to see that the external image does not reflect the sort of confusion that the baby feels internally. In the same way, cinema also provides this escapism, the pleasure of forgetting one's fragmented reality just for a couple of hours at the cinema. Now, the reason I bring up this jouissance, the sense of jouissance, is because it does play a part in the hysteric system of fantasy with regard to beauty, connected to identification with the male gaze, desiring his desire infinitely, and fearful that his desire will reach a natural end. So there's a really great quote from Mary Wollstonecraft from 1792, which intimately connects beauty and femininity. She wrote, "Taught from infancy that beauty is the woman's scepter, the mind shapes itself to the body, and roaming round its gilt cage, only seeks to adorn its prison." So it's this kind of, you know, conveying this image of the tragic seductress, that, you know, living in a sort of prison of constantly having to be beautiful, and it's an external definition of beauty as well. It's not intrinsic. It's and the mind thus shifts itself. And again, we have this kind of the word roaming, or roaming around this cage again, wandering womb, wandering mind, mind within a mind. And if any of you are familiar with the new media artist and poet Robert Montgomery, then you'll probably come across this quote. "The spectacle of advertising," he writes, "creates images of false beauty so suave and so impossible to attain that you will hurt inside and never even know where the hurt comes from." So it's really insidious, this multi-billion-dollar beauty industry that thrives on the hysteric mechanism of seduction, because the hysteric desires only infinite desire. It's the hysteric's nightmare is for desire to cease, and the beauty industry really thrives on that. It's very, very apparent. And capitalism, in a sense, turns us all into hysterics. Creatures obsessed with perfection, convinced that solutions are found in the marketplace, and our desire is never satisfied. We have been turned into the never-ending entity that only produces more and more desire. So having said that, I'm going to play a clip from the 1955 Max Ophüls film called Lola Montez. This is right at the beginning of the film. This is how the film is introduced, and I'll say a few words after we've watched the clip, but this is basically the opening scene of the film. And it's about, it's about a woman who caused a great deal of scandal for basically being a sort of fallen woman, a femme fatale, and she had many lovers, and she became disreputable, so someone talked her into basically taking her show on the road and using her persona, this femme fatale persona, as a form of entertainment so that people can come and hear the stories, the sordid stories of her many conquests. So I'll, without further ado, just play this scene and then we'll talk about it a bit. Right. So, just going back to Lola Montez. So that's a pretty daring film in a way to be making, because it's obviously challenging the idea of the way that women are treated for having perfectly healthy and normal sexuality. And in the film, Lola Montez is being represented as an actual circus freak, the fallen woman, the femme fatale, you know, as some sort of anomaly. And her the interminable parade of her lovers shown as a mockery of her desire. And obviously Lola's very beautiful and seductive, but her free spirit is an anomaly, is scandalous. Her sexuality is something that must be tamed, like a circus lion, and exploited for profit. And this goes back again to voyeuristically engaging with her and fetishizing her as a strategy of containment. And if permitted to roam freely, Lola's femininity, perceived as insatiable, threatens to destroy social order and cause painful revolutions. I mean, if you've seen the film, that's what she almost gets blamed for, you know? This sort of unbearably overwhelming southern sexuality. We must stop that at all costs. So she represents in the film love, freedom. She's a libertine. But she's everything that reactionaries detest, and they want to imprison her and kill her. So the fallen woman in the film causes men to fall in love with her, and that leads in the film to a fallen empire, a revolution. So this kind of word fallen woman falling in love, fallen empire. I thought it was interesting. Which leads me to talk about the idea of women as being insatiable in film, or in general. The woman's body being perceived as capable of producing infinite numbers of orgasms by some men, and the fact that, you know, her physiology seems to be separate from the phallus, which must rise and fall. And infinity is not a number, but a special kind of counting that doesn't stop. So, you know, that's in a way this sort of mythology of feminine sexuality. You know, she can have as many orgasms as she wants. You know, she doesn't have to wait. And anyway, so it's a special kind of number that doesn't stop. And the mysterious female anatomy in this sense transgresses the rules that must govern and limit the male anatomy. And part of the typical definition of God is that he's infinite. Limitlessness is challenging in a finite material world dominated by capitalism, dominated by scarce capitalist commodities. And yet the woman's body, you know, in relation to that, is anarchic, lawless. It can have infinite orgasms. And femininity here is sort of painted as the ultimate mystery. The woman's insatiable sexual desire occupying the paradoxical position of alluring and threatening at the same time. It reminds me of Simone de Beauvoir's quote about women being all that man desires and all that he does not attain, capturing the sort of impossibility of desire in the study of femininity. So I'll just show the last clip for the evening. Just a small scene from, it's actually a film within Almodovar's film, Talk to Her, Hablo con Ella, released in 2012. And it's basically, I don't know if you've seen the film, but it's the part where the male nurse talks about a silent film that he's seen the night before called The Shrunken Lover. And I'm just going to show a bit from the silent film, effectively. Yeah. So the whole premise of that short film is that the man, to prove to his lover that he's not selfish, he drinks a special concoction, like a special potion, and shrinks. And then he sort of stays very close to the woman all the time. And in this scene, we see the man approaching the sleeping woman. And it's important to note that she's sleeping because, you know, then she's sort of in the domain of the unconscious. And he treats her as his own private magical playground, a land with breasts as rolling hills and the vagina as a mysterious cave. And the Shrunken Lover, the film, The Shrunken Lover, that Almodovar is referring to, it plays on the archetype of the giantess, the female giant. And the tiny man in the film, he wants to stay inside the woman forever, united with her in this way. And it's the sleeping woman, her name is Amparo, which means shelter. And she's in this way like a protective womb. And the shrunken man is not seeking sexual release, as far as we can tell. He just wants the comfort which he literally finds in her. So it's this sort of regression from adulthood back to the state of being a fetus. And it's very important to emphasize in the film this kind of inequality between the perceived big, infinite power of woman and the sort of shrunken, maybe impotent condition of the man in the film. And so this is the source. This is what everybody's afraid of. This is what, you know, all these, the horror films that I'm going to be looking at next week, the horror and melodramatic films, we'll be touching on this sort of, the unspeakable, you know. So just a final couple of slides now, and then I'm going to leave some time for a discussion. I'd like to hear from you as well and hear what you have to say. Freud was genuinely puzzled by femininity. given the girl's prehistory of love and attachment to the mother, he wondered why would she switch allegiances to the father and the Oedipus complex. And since prior to genital organization, she also goes through the sort of typical phallic stage, the masturbatory stage, why would she switch the site of bodily pleasure from clitoris to vagina? He was really puzzled by all of this. And at the time, I think actually people sometimes, I think, mistakenly refer to Freud as a misogynist. But in fact, for his time, writing in the time that he was writing in, and the beliefs that were held about women, he was actually a pioneer to open up the dialogue and conversation about feminine sexuality. Prior to him, you know, it was a very sort of limited and limiting world for women and their sexuality. So these were among the sort of mysteries that Freud designates when referring to the riddle of femininity, asking, what does a woman want? Imagining her as a dark continent and having the courage to go and explore the dark continent. So this kind of understanding of sexual identity, not as rooted in anatomy, but rather as a form of individuation and differentiation, realized through complex interactions between bodily drives and human interactions. It's important to note that it's not, you know, and it sort of paves the way also for the feminist film theorists who wrote about psychoanalysis and cinema, starting with Malvi, who said that classical Hollywood narrative was phallocentric, that the spectator is typically situated in the masculine position, whilst the female figure is typically portrayed as the object of desire. And men look, they're the active voyeur, and women receive the male gaze, they're the passive exhibitionists. Marianne Doan added that a certain kind of overpresence of the female image, you know, tied to fetishism, makes it that the female spectator wants to become the image. She is the image. Elizabeth Cowie said that cinema is a dominant apparatus for producing public forms of fantasy. And this is a great quote from Angela Carter. In the celluloid brothel of cinema, where merchandise may be eyed endlessly but never purchased, tension between beauty of women, which is admirable, and the denial of their sexuality, which is the source of that beauty, but also immoral, reaches a perfect impasse. So it's a really big dilemma and predicament. So before I open up the floor to discussion, I just wanted to show you what I saw yesterday. This is a screen grab of the Daily Mail website, and if any of you have ever visited this website, it's notorious for this kind of thing. All of the stories, this is just from yesterday, so this is really recent. All of the stories here are talking about just sort of focusing in on various famous women's body parts, whether it's their cleavage or their, you know, their bum, or if they're flash their boobs, or if they're trim versus heavy. Talks about breast cancer and that somebody nearly lost, you know, it cost her breast. And I love this quote. This is like really ridiculous. Beyonce apparently has said, "I've earned the right to be me." Beyonce opens up about being vulnerable and stripping off for her sexy song. "I've earned the right to be me." Okay, that's like a whole other course. I don't know how you earn the right to be you. But you know, this constant, you know, it's just constant. And this is basically just to prove how formulaic it's become. If you can see my little, you can't see, but in this kind of the last column, look at the Cindy Crawford and then the Heidi Klum stories. They're exactly the same. They're makeup free, radiant, and going out with their boyfriends. It's literally the same story, but just different women. So it's really fetishizing, but it's so formulaic. Anyway, you'll probably see the exact same thing tomorrow with just different faces, but the same signifier is constantly being repeated in this way about women. But why is this even important? You know, why does this matter? Well, Mail Online is the website of the tabloid newspaper Daily Mail, and it's the most popular news site in the world. This is the most popular news site in the world, with over 150 million visitors per month. So, you know, this is why it's significant. And I think the conversation about hysteria sheds light about why is this mechanism happening. So the wandering room has sort of morphed into the wandering news story, you know, the constant thing happening again over and over again, these things being said about women. Anyway, so that's all I had to say about seduction. I'm going to open up the floor for a discussion. And I would like to hear if, you know, I mean, we can talk about other things. You don't have to talk about these things, but just to whet the appetite a bit, because we have about 25 minutes until our time tonight finishes. So it'd be interesting to hear it from you. But I thought it would be interesting to ask you what other films you can think of that contain the sort of hysterical seduction scenes. And obviously, you know, certain media representations of female celebrities are harmful in their attitudes, in the way that they shape attitudes about women. But should they be censored? Why or why not? I don't think they should be censored, but I'd like to hear from you. Because censoring them is not going to make them go away. And what about the reverse gaze these days? Because it seems like, you know, now there's all these magazines for men popping up with, all of them are about fitness and about like 8-packs for men. So there seems to be like a lust, like a, some sort of revenge, the lustful female eyes looking at men. And also these sort of new professions like naked butlers, which is like crazy. But men are sort of naked butlers and they're being ogled and they're being fetishized. But it's still a hysterical mechanism, that's the thing. And also, just to make it a bit, you know, beyond film and beyond psychoanalysis, all the revelations about NSA surveillance and spying, operating, obviously, voyeurism, so looking into, you know, it's literally the lives of others, looking into our lives, spying on us, and fetishizing us as well, so exaggerating certain so-called crimes, whereas much worse crimes are being committed by governments. Is this a strategy for population containment? Is this a way of fencing off our desire as citizens? Anyway, I'll just leave you to either, you know, go with those or completely, you know, come up with your own ideas about what you want to discuss. But that's it from me, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So are you asking whether hysteria becomes almost the inevitable symptom of the woman who can be defined as classically attractive? Yes. 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 I think there is a relationship there, because I think that it's not necessarily classically beautiful women that might experience it, but as you say, the one who just wants to please and may look, you know, actually quite, let's say, plain. But ultimately, it's the end game is the same, because it's still trying to provoke endless desire in the other and relate, identify with the other's desire. So the wanting to please is also, in a way, operating within the same mechanisms of seduction. I believe so anyway, but what do you think? Yes. Hmm. Or whether it's actually Oh, yeah. Sure. Yes, or the one who has heavily repressed her desire to the point of negating it completely. And so that would allow that sort of facade of, in a way, like Marilyn in the, you know, we're meant to believe that she's not aware of his sexual attraction towards her. You know, she's just being perfectly innocent. It's all very wholesome. But of course, there's this sort of seething, you know, mechanism of desire. But I think that's very interesting. It makes me then start, you know, my automatic reaction to hearing that kind of new perspective is going through my mental film archive. You know, what film scene matches what you just said? That's very interesting.
Yeah, can I just pick up on the theme of hysteria? Because with the best ball in the world, I don't see Marilyn Monroe in 7 Year Itch as hysteric, nor do I see Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct as hysteric. Because hysteria, as I understand it, is actually feminine resistance to masculine sexuality. Hysteria arises because the feminine subject can't or won't accept the role that is set out for her within the masculine model of sexuality. So this is why, for instance, if you look at the work, and you mentioned Jean-Martin Charcot, for instance, at Salpêtrière, he was the first person to actually write about eating disorders. Mm. You know, and eating disorders are actually a symptom of hysteria, and hysteria is the feminine rejection of the masculine positioning of feminine sexuality as this passive thing that's actually quite dangerous and so needs to be contained. Whereas the two women in Marilyn Monroe and Sharon Stone seem to be quite happy to accept their positioning and work within that. They don't resist it really in any way that I can see. So, you know, I mean, I don't, in terms of hysteria, hysteria is actually women saying no. It's, you know, it's a very forceful rejection of the masculine positioning of the feminine subject within a system where masculinity is prioritized. And what's interesting about your talk is that there doesn't seem to be in any of the models that you've given, a way of the feminine being articulated in any way beyond what is set out within existing structures that favor masculinity.
Okay, well, that's a very good point, and I'm glad you raised it, because it's actually, this is not the ultimate point that I'm going to be making throughout the course. I will be touching on exactly what you just said in the second and third installments, especially in Demons, because I think that that's where the conflict of hysteria really arises. What I was trying to do in this segment of the course, the first one, was to establish the groundwork of how, you know, in a way, the context for why the resistance takes place. So the first phase being seduction. So this, this sort of, in a way,
it's a very normative model of sexuality, I suppose, what we see.
Sure. But yes, of course. And it's something that I've encountered in the films that I've watched and the way in which I relate it to cinema. But it just seemed to me that, yes, absolutely, I agree with you that, well, first of all, I would never call the Monroe and Sharon Stone, characters in those scenes as hysteric. The reason why I showed those scenes was actually to establish the mechanisms of voyeurism and fetishism and how they contribute to then establishing the system within which women operate, and then they do experience a conflict, they do experience resistance, as you put it. If you're coming next week, then I think there you will see in the demons section of the course, you'll see exactly what you're touching on. So I hope you'll come.
I fully intend to.
Oh, good. good. But yes, I agree with you, and it's certainly not, you know, this is not the end of the story when it comes to hysteria. This is just setting the scene for, I guess, yes, a normative spectrum or a normative landscape for sexuality that then creates this conflict within the woman and how she defines her own sexuality in relation to what is being dominated around her and what dominates.
Yeah. I suppose it may come up later in the process. I may be preempting you in a few pieces if I am.
That's okay.
But do you see femininity as being inherently something that pertains to women and masculinity as something that pertains
no.
to men? Because that's certainly the theme that's come up here.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Okay.
So yes, I will be touching on this as well. Okay, yeah. But thank you for your comments. Is there any other?
I found it really interesting. Pushing all these films back to back, you just watch them as a one-off, you just kind of accept them as the norm. You
know? Sure.
Watching these two films together, it kind of really struck me as being these like complete male fantasies that don't really connect with real life at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Lola Montez and the Belle de Jour, they seem to these very interesting kind of divided characters, kind of fractures, but kind of working through their conflicts.
Yes.
Quite sort of human. And I couldn't believe, actually, you know, when I watched the film, then looked up Wikipedia, and Lola Montez was a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And the film, if anything, plays down the reality of her life.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary.
But these two, the Marilyn Monroe and the Sharon Stone, they're just kind of like, I mean, they're such fantasy characters from a male point of view.
Yeah.
Can you really connect them with the real women and real femininity?
I can only speak for myself because I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I don't actually see, you know, patients or clients, and I don't have that sort of insight into what, you know, those sort of conflicts might be in the female population. But in terms of my own research and my own experience as a woman, I felt like I watched those films when I was growing up, and I watched those kinds of, you know, those kinds of films. Certainly the genre of classical, you know, the golden age of Hollywood, that's what I sort of cut my teeth on cinematically. And for me personally, yes, they defined a certain kind of femininity, and a certain kind of being, you know, a way of being as a woman. And it was not until I started to read psychoanalysis and certainly the feminist film theorist that I started to really question, you know, that actually this is only one way and one definition of femininity, and it's coming from the man's point of view, his perspective, and that's why, in a way, for me personally, especially when I was a teenager, and everyone goes, you know, some people go through an awkward stage as a teenager when everything feels so tumultuous in your life and your body is changing and there's so much mystery around sexuality and there's so much confusion. As a woman watching, you know, Hollywood films, or certainly the ones from the classical period, it was that sort of feeling of jubilation in a way of seeing
the whole Lacanian mirror thing.
Yes, exactly. A jouissance of seeing something reflected back to you, something that's whole and beautiful, compelling. And that certainly happened, especially with Marilyn. I was a big fan of hers. But also then later discovering how she was as a person behind, you know, beyond the realm of the cameras and beyond the realm of the studio system, how she suffered and how she suffered from things like stuttering and how she was actually very, very insecure in some ways. You know, such a contrast to Elizabeth Taylor, who had such a command, presence and confidence. So yeah, I really related to that. So yes, of course, it's not the universal definition, And that's why this course is, in a way, always going to be really my projection. It's not going to be the definitive explanation of hysteria, and nor do I want it to be. Go ahead. Yes. 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 Yeah. That's true. Yes, I agree. I agree.
I was just going to make a comment about the toast popping up in films.
Yes.
Because I always look out for sort of visual metaphors and in films, and often they are just sort of about the phallus, aren't they? And
sure.
Erections and all of that, and even the milk and stuff. And I was wondering, I always sort of try to look out for where there's the female visual metaphors for their orgasms. Mm. And I wasn't sure if you were going to touch on that at all, or whether it was, because, you know, I'm just quite interested in knowing,
yes,
I suppose, if that is ever explored, I suppose, in the films that you might be talking about.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a really good point. And in that very scene in Bitter Moon, right after the toast comes popping out, immediately after that, well, we have certainly the scene with the razor, and so there, her power as a seductress is being tested in the point of view of the spectator. So she's no longer just like, you know, sexual, exciting, and playful. Now she's also dangerous. Immediately after that, we see them together in the shower. And that's when he starts to really describe in full detail her genitalia. But they're both sort of, there's too much fog in the shower, so you don't actually see their full figures or shapes, but you can tell that it's them and that he's, you know, performing cunnilingus. And it's just sort of, maybe the visual metaphor is that they're just completely immersed in the shower with the water rushing over their bodies, and that you don't even see them anymore. They're lost in this sort of hazy universe of her sexuality, of her orgasm is, you know, creates that sort of all-encompassing, immersive, womb-like, you know, structure, but also in a way, also still dangerous, like the unconscious, you know, not really being able to, you don't know your bearings, you know, you can't see any toasts popping anywhere. It's just, yes, it's this kind of other world. And actually, I'm going to be touching on that aspect of the feminine orgasm, the feminine condition of sexuality in transcendence, the final. Yeah, but yeah, that's a very good, that's a very good point. I saw a hand popping.
Yeah, I was just
saying
in response to that, there's one film that I see that does do that. It's called Ama, Spanish. And there's a scene where she's in the bath and she's sort of, she's masturbating and she's like filling the bath up. But it's kind of,
It's interesting, isn't it, that immersion thing, because Marilyn talks about being in the bath.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, she was sleeping, but, you know, Venus coming from the waves, Bo Derek walking out of the sea,
mm-hmm,
you know, Ursula Andress, Dr. No.
That's right.
Daniel Craig.
But that whole thing of both being overwhelmed.
Sure.
Of kind of, it's just a different sort of thing, isn't it? Why the only man here?
Yeah, well, going back to the Polanski movie, I was quite surprised that you didn't come out and say This is a direct reference to the money shot in porn.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it was. It was a direct reference to the moment at the end of the porn scene. It's called the money shot. It's what everyone's paid their money for, and that's when the woman ends up covered in jizz, basically. And it's taken to its kind of inevitable extreme in Japanese porn. There's a particular form of Japanese porn called bukkake, where all that happens is women end up absolutely covered in the stuff, because you're not allowed to show a man ejaculating under Japanese censorship rules. So that's always off screen. So there's all of these kind of metaphors that end up getting used.
Sure.
But that's ultimate. That's the bottom line. That's what it is. It's porn.
Because it's milk and because it's like her breasts and.
Rather than just pure jizz.
Yeah. It's interesting the way you said all this as an aside. I thought she looked a bit like a zombie. Well, I think she did look a bit like a zombie, and I don't think that was accidental either.
No, of course.
And I think it was. I don't know that I haven't seen the rest of the film. I don't really know, but it seemed to me as if it was it was already getting nightmarish, obviously, and it was also kind of like a parody, a strange sort of comic, and firing the gun at the ducks and things like that. It's as if somehow he was sort of Polanski is picking it apart, and that ambivalence of the male gaze, I think, is something that, and the female gaze, is something that's often sort of not talked about. But it's not straightforward.
No.
There are all sorts of ambivalence and play promises and women seeing it from men's point of view and men seeing it from women's point of view. And
Complex. Yes. It's worth seeing the film in its entirety because it's not all that black and white. And there are more subtleties going on. I would say that he probably, I mean, I don't know for sure, but when I watched it, I thought that it was very, very exaggerated and a very, very good example of, especially that scene of romanticizing something that happened, because his character is a writer. He's an American who moved to Paris to live, you know, as Hemingway or Henry Miller, these Americans in Paris, and he's this sort of romantic character, and he chased her all over Paris. He saw her one time on the bus, and then he never saw her again, and he chased her all over Paris trying to find her, and he had this sort of very idealized version of her in his mind. So I think that the way that he's recounting, because we don't actually hear her version of how they first met, that's his version. And so it's very idealized, it's very grandiose, it's very exaggerated, like you say, comic book style almost with the gun, and it's very American, that bit as well.
Stalking has turned into such an endearing habit when it's told in the context of a male romance narrative.
I mean, I certainly didn't mean, I didn't mean it as an endearing, I didn't mean to
condone. No, sorry, I'm talking about
the film. Oh, yes. it is quite funny.
Maybe I'm just a little bit cynical.
Oh, no.
I'm conceivable.
No. No, you're right. It is, and also the Hugh Grant character. He starts to become very infatuated, maybe a little bit obsessed with this person because they. It's worth seeing the film anyway. I won't ruin it for you, but it's interesting. We have. We're nearly out of time. Maybe time for one more question, and then we'll have to stop here. Was there anything else? Any burning? Oh, yes.
This is called about love between two women.
Yes.
It was interesting that critics wrote that so all of film critics are men. Film was directed by a man, and sort of it was a little bit criticized with sort of love stories, sort of seen through eyes of a man.
Yes.
But sort of, I really enjoyed that film and I'm not sure how obviously it connects when you have a sort of theme masculinity and feminine. So it's very complex, isn't it? Because a younger girl meets an older student. She's more masculine in that sense.
Yes.
I just thought it's another interesting film to see how sort of, to think about in terms of what we thought about today. And in a sense, it's sort of how it progresses with time, because like Marilyn was in the 50s, then the 80s, and now so 2013 that film won a sort of Cannes prize.
Yes.
Yes,
it's very interesting. And it touches on what was mentioned before about, you know, what you said about about the interchangeability of genders in the construction of hysteria, that it's not necessarily that the man can never be a hysteric when a woman is depicted as hysteric or experienced as hysterical, you know, the position, the structure of hysteria, that it can also be in a lesbian relationship, and that her partner can assume that traditionally male role of having the dominant, you know, the possessing the phallus in that way, and having the dominant gaze, and I think that plays out very well in Blue is the Warmest Color, because the young is it Adele? She's so lovely, and she portrays this kind of the experience of falling in love and seduction in such an endearing way. So it was a shame that it turned out that the actors and everyone on the set experienced difficulties with the director, and that he was quite bullying towards them. It's a shame to think that, but I think that everyone who worked on the film, those people involved with the director, they put in a great performance, and it's really down to them. I want to believe that it's despite him, not because of him, that they were so great. But yeah, it's a really good suggestion of another title to look at. So we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. But thank you. Thank you very much. See you next week,
yes,
I hope.
See you next week.
Great. Mm-hmm.